This podcast is recorded in 2022. Diabetes is an incredibly common chronic disease with an ever-increasing prevalence. NICE estimate that by 2025, there will be up to 5 million people living with diabetes in the UK, with 90% of these individuals having type 2 diabetes. Welcome to Plabable, Pods for Docs. My name is Sophia, and in today's podcast, we will be covering the topic of type 2 diabetes. For visual aids on this topic, head over to our website at plabable.com for high-yield revision notes and a question bank. Today, we are very fortunate to be joined by our famous Plabable owner, Z, who also works as a GP. Welcome, Z. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Sophia. So yes, we do come across a lot of patients with type 2 diabetes in primary care. Type 1 diabetes is often handled by secondary care, but we see almost a type 2 diabetic patient every single day.
So diabetes is fundamentally a problem with blood glucose regulation. And to understand the cause of the disease, it's quite good to just go back and touch on how blood sugar is normally regulated in a healthy state. So you've got two hormones that control blood glucose, and both of these are made in the pancreas. So the first one to bear in mind is insulin. This is made by the beta cells. This one promotes glucose uptake into cells and basically decreases your blood glucose level. The other hormone is glucagon. That's made by the alpha cells, and this works to increase glucose levels in the blood. So what is diabetes then? So diabetes is a general term that describes metabolic disorders characterized by an increased blood sugar or hyperglycemia. And there's two different types. So you've got type 1, which we would cover in a separate podcast. And then you've got type 2, which is the one that we're going to talk about today. And type 2 is where the hyperglycemia or high blood sugar is caused by essentially an insulin resistance and eventually a relative insulin deficiency as well. And type 2 is by far the most common type of diabetes, as I said before, with 90% of diabetics actually being type 2. So Z, let's look at this from a more clinical perspective now. Can you talk us through some of the risk factors associated with type 2 and tell us a bit more about them?
Yes. So when you think about type 2 diabetes, often you're thinking about risk factors of someone who is living a very unhealthy lifestyle, obesity, inactivity. Sometimes you have patients with a family history of type 2 diabetes. In fact, people with family history of type 2 diabetes are 2 to 6 times more likely than those without family history. Ethnicity is also a big thing. Asians, Africans, Afro-Caribbeans. And so they are actually screened in the UK as well for type 2 diabetes. Other risk factors are things like polycystic ovary syndrome, PCOS, or metabolic syndromes, because there's often a raised blood pressure, dyslipidemia, fatty liver, and central obesity as well.
Before we look at diagnosing type 2 diabetes, let's think about how it might present initially in a primary care setting. And as usual, we tend to use a clinical scenario to illustrate this a bit more clearly. So let's consider this patient, a 62-year-old male taxi driver, presents to his GP. He's got increasing tiredness. He's got polyuria, so he's weeing a lot. And he's noticed these changes over the past few months. They're quite insidious changes. Initially, he thought it might have been his prostate because of his age, but now he's developed a bit of numbness in his toes and in his fingers, and that's why he's come to his GP, as he's a bit worried. Z, can you talk us through the salient parts of that history and talk us through the other signs and symptoms that can be suggestive of diabetes?
Absolutely. So this is a very classical case of type 2 diabetes, right? Someone who's come in, I think the key features here are the polyuria and the tiredness as well. His age fits with someone who would normally have type 2 diabetes. Remember, it's the older adult, you know, generally above 40 years old. That's sort of where you sort of think, oh, type 2 diabetes. He's got a sedentary job. He's a taxi driver. So you can think, oh, gosh, he's probably not very active. And then his main issue is that, oh, gosh, he's got numbness in his toes and fingers. Sorry, that's not his main issue actually, but he does have those symptoms as well. I suppose you have to remember in diabetes, there's also this glove stocking neuropathy that can develop. So those are things that make you think of diabetes. For me, what I would do in this case would be thinking about what bloods I need to request. And often when anyone comes in with tiredness, we often request a range of blood tests from, you know, checking their thyroid levels, checking their full blood counts as a reason for being tired, if they're anemic, for example. But alongside all those tests, we will also be checking their HbA1c or fasting glucose level. So those would be the things that would be in my mind at that stage.
Okay, I think that brings us on quite nicely to the bit I wanted to come on to next, and that's the diagnostic criteria for type 2 diabetes, because these are quite specific, and there's various different blood measurements that we use in this process. So blood glucose we can measure in a few different ways. There's three main ways to consider when it comes to type 2. So the first one is something called HbA1c, and this basically gives you a measure of something called glycated hemoglobin. And in basic terms, what that means is you look at the blood glucose average over about 2 to 3 months. And this correlates with the lifespan of a normal red blood cell. Another measurement you can use is something called fasting plasma glucose. And that's normally a blood test that's taken after 8 to 10 hours of fasting. And then there's also something called a random plasma glucose. So that's where you just take a random sample of blood, doesn't matter if you fasted or not, and you take a measure of the glucose at that point in time. So Z, can you talk us through what diagnostic tests you use and how we interpret these?
Yes, it depends if your patient's symptomatic or asymptomatic. If your patient has symptoms of diabetes, and this is usually polydipsia, polyuria, then you only need one abnormal test. So I'm talking about one abnormal HbA1c or one abnormal fasting glucose. While random plasma glucose are part of what the NICE guidelines mention, rarely do we do them because fasting glucose is just slightly more accurate than a random plasma glucose. So it's either we do a HbA1c or a fasting plasma glucose for someone who's symptomatic. Again, we only need one abnormal value, and then we can say, yes, this is diabetes. If they were asymptomatic, let's say, you know, you were screened them because they were Asian or because maybe they just had a little bit of tiredness, no polydipsia, polyuria, you know, it's just, you just screened them for another reason, and they somehow came back with a high HbA1c or a high fasting plasma glucose, then you want to repeat the tests because you need two abnormal tests to diagnose diabetes in someone who is asymptomatic. And this two abnormal tests can be two HbA1cs, it could be two fasting plasma glucose, or it could be one of each, one HbA1c that's abnormal and a fasting plasma glucose that's abnormal as well. So remember, two abnormal tests for an asymptomatic patient. Now, some doctors would ask me, gosh, in an exam scenario, they would ask you to pick an HbA1c or a fasting plasma glucose. What would you pick? It's a bit tricky. I don't think any examiner or any question writer would ever write a question like that because both are applicable. HbA1cs, in my mind, would make more sense because the management of how you handle them takes into account the HbA1c value. It doesn't take into account the fasting glucose value. So it makes sense to do a HbA1c. But of course, there are a lot of reasons why you would avoid a HbA1c, which I'll come to a bit later. In terms of costs, they're almost around the same amount as well. So back in 2015, I think the cost of a fasting blood glucose was £12 and a HbA1c was £14. So you're not really saving the NHS a lot of money by doing a fasting blood glucose first. So in summary, what I'm trying to say here is question writers shouldn't be giving you a choice to choose a HbA1c or a fasting glucose. But if they did, I would lean towards a HbA1c. So what are the abnormal values? So an abnormal HbA1c would be 48 or more. And the unit that we use here would be millimoles per mole. This is equivalent to 6.5%, but we very rarely use percentages. Labs often report it as millimole per mole. So if anything, that's the one you want to memorize. Fasting plasma glucose levels that are abnormal are where it's 7 or more. And for a random plasma glucose level that is abnormal, that would sit in the category of 11.1 or more. And the unit there would be millimoles per liter. So those are the abnormal values. You have to memorize that, especially if you're sitting for your exams. Now, if we go back to the above case of what Sophia was mentioning there about that taxi driver who has tiredness and polyuria. Now, which test would you do for him would depend also on how long he's symptomatic for. If he was symptomatic for a few months, then you would say HbA1c would be great because you can then manage him based on that value. You know which medications to use, whether lifestyle would be appropriate or whether starting him on a medication would be appropriate. But if his symptoms were less than 2 months, then HbA1cs would be something you want to avoid. And this comes back to what Sophia mentioned, you know, it reflects the red blood cells, and red blood cells typically last for 3 months. So you want to avoid a HbA1c if his symptoms only are present for less than 2 months. Instead, then you would use a fasting plasma glucose.
Something worth noting before we move on, actually, is that the HbA1c test isn't necessarily suitable for everyone. And this has come up in my exams previously, so it's worth mentioning now. So as the test is dependent on your red blood cells, you need to make sure that it's interpreted with caution or alternatives are used. In people who have an abnormal red cell turnover or a particularly abnormal hemoglobin, and various things can cause that. So things like hemoglobinopathy, so something like sickle cell disease. If people have really severe anemia, that can also affect the HbA1c. And also people who have had a recent transfusion, be that for a medical purpose like the thalassemia or, you know, while they've been in hospital. So it's worth bearing that in mind when you're measuring people's HbA1c.
Yes. And on top of that as well, some people also forget HbA1c should not be used with pregnant women and children under 18, because that's one of those things, you know, people often forget. Don't use HbA1cs in those people.
Diabetes can be really debilitating. It's a systemic disease. And if it's not managed appropriately, you can get quite severe complications associated with it. Persistent hyperglycemia and erratic blood sugar can cause a multitude of issues. And this leads to the complications that we famously associate with the condition. So Z, can you talk us through some of these complications and what we do to monitor these?
Yes. So I'm just going to give you a quick summary here, because this is something that you might want to tell your patients why we are trying to control their diabetes so well, right? We're trying to prevent two big groups of complications, the macrovascular and the microvascular. And the macrovascular complications are things like cardiovascular diseases, the strokes, the peripheral artery disease, the heart problems you get, the myocardial infarctions. For the microvascular ones, those are things like nephropathy, retinopathies, peripheral neuropathies. Those are the complications that come if we don't control the blood glucose over a long period of time. Those are the ones that you have to focus on.
So a new diagnosis can be quite life-changing for patients, and therefore the management of diabetes is very broad and involves lots of people across the whole MDT. We obviously can't cover absolutely everything in this podcast episode, but we can give you kind of a broad overview of how we manage type 2. So each patient tends to have an individualized care plan. You consider the patient's age, how comorbid they are otherwise, and what their diabetic disease burden is like when they've been diagnosed. So as with most things in medicine, we tend to start with conservative management where possible and work our way up. Lifestyle, as we've said previously, is a huge risk factor for diabetes and a good place to start. So Z, let's go through some of the lifestyle advice that you give patients and, you know, the other conservative measurements that you put in place for those with a new diagnosis.
Yes, absolutely. So what doctors often forget is type 2 diabetes is bread and butter for a GP, because we handle the majority of type 2 diabetes. We tell them about lifestyle changes, we start them on medications, and only in the very few people that we cannot handle because it's so complicated do we refer on to the endocrinology team. When we typically see a patient who's newly diagnosed with diabetes, the number one thing that comes into our head is trying to advise them about how diet and exercise can really change their glucose levels. It's so important that in every step in diabetes management, we talk about diet and exercise. It's quite straightforward. You know, you listen to the patient, you hear what he's eating, you hear what he's drinking, you try and adjust it to improve his sugar levels. And exercise, NICEKS recommends that, you know, you should do 30 minutes of exercise 5 times a week. So that's what typically what I tell my patients, 30 minutes of exercise 5 times a week, you know, that can sort of help. I think the question that often doctors ask on the in a course when we do our plebable courses is, you know, how long should they be doing a trial of diet and exercise? And I would say it's roughly around 3 to 6 months is when we would say, let's try a course of diet and exercise. And then we repeat the HbA1c at the end of that. Now, in clinical practice, it's usually a bit longer. It's usually about 12 months. That's because we have a system put in place to review diabetics every year. So sometimes we don't always get to see them within 3 to 6 months. But the recommendations by NICE is to review someone who has abnormal HbA1cs every 3 to 6 months, especially in the early periods, because you really want to make sure that they have good glycemic control. Do we start them on medications right away once they're diagnosed? The answer is, in most cases, no, because in most cases, the HbA1c is sitting just slightly elevated above 48. And so we always tell them, hey, let's try diet and exercise first. I think we can get the level to a target, which is less than 48, and with just diet and exercise. And they would normally walk away saying, yes, I'm going to try that. There are some people that we would say, you probably need to start on medications. And these are people where the HbA1cs are extremely high. I'm talking about a HbA1c of maybe 80, 90, where you know in 3 to 6 months' time, this patient is not going to be able to get his HbA1c to be below 48. So why are we even trying just diet and exercise? We probably want to start him on a medication like metformin or sulfonylurea, anything to try and get his HbA1c to a better level within 3 to 6 months. I think the most important bit, which I want to stress here that you have to remember, right, is if the HbA1c reaches these levels, which I'm going to say now, start monotherapy or intensify the treatment, all right? If the patient's on lifestyle alone, that number is 48 millimoles per mole. If the person is on a drug therapy, the number is 58 millimoles per mole. That is the golden sentence, because that alone is enough to help you know when to pick lifestyle changes or when to pick drug therapy in the exam. It's really, really important, right? I mean, when I say monotherapy, I usually mean metformin, because that's the first drug that we normally would start someone on. There are only a few people that would not be able to start metformin because it's contraindicated or they can't tolerate it. So that's the meaning of monotherapy.
So alongside the measures that Z's already covered, there are obviously other medications, which we've talked about the threshold at which you'd start that. So let's go through some of the medications. There's lots of them out there, things including metformin, sulfonylureas, pioglitazone, insulin, and there's some very comprehensive guidelines, which to supplement your learning, you know, they're on the NICE website. We've also got plenty of questions on our website as well, which can help test this. And it's worth going through the medications when you start them and when you step up the chain. Let's discuss what medications are available to people with type 2 diabetes and go through the process of changing medications. So Z, do you want to kick us off?
Yes. So let me repeat this part. Right after diagnosis, we start with lifestyle and diet first for most of them. And then we move to a monotherapy if the HbA1c rises 48 or higher. That's when you start monotherapy. And monotherapy means metformin. Now, when we start metformin, we want to make sure that we start low and go slow. What I mean by this is we start 500 milligrams first, and then we creep up to adding another tablet of 500 milligrams after a week. And then adding up to a point of a maximum of 2 grams, which is 2,000 milligrams of metformin in total in a day. So the reason that we start low and go slow is because there's a lot of side effects, GI side effects, especially diarrhea. And if a patient is starting on 2 grams of metformin and has diarrhea, he's not going to try metformin anymore. So you want to make sure that you start low and go slow. Let's say 6 months later or a year later, you check his HbA1c again. Now remember, he's probably on a maximum dose of metformin that he can tolerate now, right? And let's say his HbA1c is 60. That's a hint in the exam to say, gosh, you probably want to start another medication. Now, that's when you intensify medication. Why? It's because his HbA1c is now 58 or more. And that's where you say, let's intensify the medication. Let's add on more medications. Now, it's important as well to reinforce advice on lifestyle, including diet, at every stage. Remember, so when you see him in an appointment, you again tell him how important lifestyle changes are, how important the diet is. On top of that, I'd like to start you on more medications. So what medications do you start him on? Now, this is up for grabs, right? There's so many medications out there. This is where you can sort of think, gosh, you know what? What medication is going to help this specific individual right in front of me? And this really depends if he's got a high BMI or he's a lorry driver, he's an ambulance driver, he's a pilot. All these things matter because that would help you choose what to pick as the second line option. I'll give you a couple of examples here. The common ones are things like SGLT2 inhibitors. So this would be perfect for people who drive because, look, the risk of hypoglycemic events are low. It's also good for patients with heart failure, with reduced ejection fraction. That would be one of the things that you could think about. Other medications like pioglitazones, great drugs as well. Risk of hypoglycemia is also low, but there are problems with this as well. You know, it can cause weight gain. So you probably won't want to use this in a patient with a high BMI. You also want to avoid this in patients with heart failure. Pioglitazone should not be used with patients with heart failure. So really individualizing the treatment here. And then you've got other things like sulfonylureas or glycosides is what we would prescribe. The risk of hypoglycemia here is high. So it wouldn't quite be appropriate to prescribe this for someone who is flying a plane or driving an ambulance. You wouldn't want this person to have a hypoglycemic event. So really avoid these medications in people who drive or who use heavy machinery. Sulfonylureas can also cause weight gain, so something to be aware of. And then there are things like gliptins or DPP-4 inhibitors. Risk of hypoglycemia is low here. It's weight neutral. There's a small risk of pancreatitis. These are things that you would typically use as your second line, right? There is a big change in 2022, right? And I think this is where there is such great importance with SGLT2 inhibitors because now it actually can be used as first line alongside metformin as well for patients with chronic heart failure or high risk of cardiovascular diseases. Diabetes has been quite constant over the last decade, and suddenly there's this big change where SGLT2s have been seen to reduce the risk of cardiovascular diseases. So it's really up there with metformin right now. What this means in practice is that regardless of HbA1c, if you're having type 2 diabetes and you're on metformin, and if you have a history of heart failure or a high risk of cardiovascular disease, we should be starting you on an SGLT2 inhibitor as well, something like dapagliflozin, alongside metformin. You start metformin first and then you start an SGLT2 slightly later, but you don't really need to look at the HbA1cs. There is a good example on the Plavable Question Bank about dapagliflozin, so an SGLT2 inhibitor, and when to start that. And I think if you guys look at the question code EN4807 on the Plavable Question Bank, you would be able to practice that question on dapagliflozin and when to start an SGLT2 inhibitor. Breakthrough moment for type 2 diabetes. Really revolutionized the way we approach type 2 diabetes and probably changed guidelines around the world as well.
It's really interesting though, because before you'd brought that up, I wasn't aware that SGLT2 had suddenly been brought forward in management in diabetes. So it kind of drives the point home even further of the need to stay up to date with diabetes guidelines. These are things that change quite a lot, and this is quite a big change. We've done a brief run through of type 2 diabetes during this episode, but we do strongly recommend that you keep up to date on the guidelines, which can be found very easily on the NICE website, as these are quite dynamic and they do change with research coming out And obviously we want to practice evidence-based medicine. So keep an eye out on the NICE website, but we also have useful resources on our website at pubable.com, which can help drive the point home further and help you plan your first and second line management for patients in various exam scenarios. So Z, have you got any take-home messages, closing remarks before we finish off today?
Well, just to recap, first line, most of the time is metformin in terms of a drug. And second line, up for grabs. Just choose whatever drug suits your patient. I guarantee that you will come across managing type 2 diabetes in your career. Whether you're a doctor or your physician associate, you will come across managing type 2 diabetes. It's very common in the UK. And happy studying, everybody.
So I think that's it for today. Thank you so much to Z for joining us. And thank you to you all for listening. And we hope you've enjoyed today's discussion and we hope it's been useful. To test your application, as I've said, head over to our website at pubable.com. We've got an extensive question bank and loads of revision notes for your studying. We'll see you next time. Bye.